This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have an opportunity to find out a little ahead of time what is likely to come up this coming weekend. In fact, on August 18th, there'll be dozens and dozens of Northwest Indiana parents getting together at the Arts and Sciences Building at the IU Northwest Campus in Gary to find out more about being able to find some good choices for their students' academic future and success. It's the Northwest Indiana Parent Celebration and Education Expo that is being put on, sponsored by the number of groups, in particular with the Indiana Parenting Institute. And with us in the studio, we have a couple representatives of the IPI here. We have Kendra Johnson, who's in the studio, along with Janae Beleza, who we've talked to, of course, before on the program about IPI programs. Thank you, ladies, for being in today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Well, tell us a little bit about the ideas behind this upcoming Parent Celebration and the Education Expo. How did it get started? And in turn, I guess the incentive that parents have all across Northwest Indiana to participate this weekend.
Well, the incentive actually came from the young lady sitting next to me, Ms. Kendra Johnson. She's been what I would call a parent advocate in the city of Gary for a while now, and she really wanted to have a conference that focused on education and really helped parents to understand the process, because it's a system, it's a process. And if you want to be successful in it, you have to understand how it operates. And so she came to us asking our assistance, and we said, sure, why not, because we do that. And I had a colleague of mine, Mr. Fred Jackson, who's with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education. They run the 21st Century Scholars Program here. Mm-hmm. And he came saying that they were looking to put on a parent conference. So we came together and decided to do this as a trio. So the main sponsors of it are the Indiana Commission for Higher Education, Indiana University, and we put this under Indiana Parenting Institute's Responsible Parenting Campaign. Basically, what we're doing is we want parents to understand that they have power. If you see on the little flyer that I gave you, it says discover your power, because a lot of times our parents don't feel that they have power. They feel that they just have to accept whatever's thrown at them, and we want them to understand that they have way more power than they're aware of, because we can all have power, right? But if we're unaware of it, then we're powerless. So that's what this conference is about. So some of the topics that we're going to be discussing are the new graduation pathways. Chris, I don't know if you know this, but starting with this year's eighth graders, there are new requirements to graduate, and I would bet that most families aren't aware of that change. And so to have the opportunity to have the Indiana Department of Education be on site to discuss this with families or with parents that are going to be at this event, I think was a huge blessing.
We got a chance to talk with Tony Walker, who's the area representative of the Indiana State Board of Education, and he talked some about the guidelines that are being created, and in fact they're working on more right now, I guess.
So I'm excited that our parents get an opportunity to hear it from the horse's mouth, if you will, and also we wanted them to understand. I serve on the governor's workforce cabinet, and I just learned something that was just very interesting, which is that the role that education plays in ensuring that we become responsible adults, you know, by helping us to understand and to acquire the knowledge and skills that we need to become gainfully employed and then productive members of society. For some reason, I don't think that most of us think of K through 12 that way. And so we wanted parents to understand that there are certain courses that your child needs to take that if they want to go into certain careers. And if you haven't prepared them for those, if you haven't allowed them to take those courses, they end up finding themselves in remediation. So I realize remediation isn't a bad word. It doesn't mean that you're stupid or that you've missed out on something significant. It just means that maybe you didn't take the classes needed to keep moving in the direction that you want to go. So understanding that component, having parents become aware of that and ensure that their child doesn't get caught up in remediation because they want to become some sort of engineer, but they haven't taken those classes in K through 12 required to prepare them for that, they now understand that and how to find those that information so that they can make sure their kids are prepared.
I imagine probably in some cases young people think they might be interested in some career path, and then all of a sudden they discover something else along the way that they said, oh, I like that better.
Right.
But unfortunately, as you say, it's not that they're not physically prepared or mentally prepared for the job. They just don't have all of the educational courses that they might need to be able to follow through on that. And I know that Kendra, you've worked so very hard on this in your opportunities here. What, I guess, gave you the opportunity to get involved with IPI, and in turn, what's gotten you involved to push for such a program like this one coming up?
Well, first of all, I have been a parent of the Gary Community School Corporation for 23 consecutive years. That means for every year of 23 years, I had at least one child in the Gary Community School Corporation. Mm-hmm. And I am the mother of six children, grandmother of seven. I would have been eight, but we lost one. And I was a low-income parent because of a tragedy that was totally unforeseen. And I wanted my children to have better. God blessed me with two girls, four boys. And we have had to battle everything from guns to drugs to deaths to, I mean, we've had a lot of bullying. I had one child that was severely bullied. We've gone through a lot. And as a single parent, I wanted other parents to see that it is possible for their children to succeed academically. My oldest daughter, well, both of my daughters have graduated high school and college with degrees. My oldest daughter works for Homeland Security. My second daughter is a regional manager for a well-known furniture store. Mm-hmm. My four boys, the oldest boy lives in Minnesota. He went through, he had learning challenges, and he's done a semester of college. He's working for a corporate office trying to be an entrepreneur, but he wants to go back and finish college. My second son has finished his first year of college at IUPUI in Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. He's the one that went through a great deal of bullying. My fifth child just graduated high school, and he was extremely close to the grandson that I lost in a fire. And so it was really, really hard for him to finish these last 2 years because the fire happened in 2016. And my last son, my baby boy, he is a junior at Westside Leadership Academy, and he wants to become an electrical engineer. And, you know, it's amazing when I look back at all of this. I am thankful and grateful to a wonderful woman named Irma Lauderdale, who took the time out to help train me in Title I federal law. But in the process of training me on what my rights and responsibilities were as a parent, I realized that there were other things that came into play that parents didn't know about, how to do an IEP, the laws that are put into place that affect education, and most importantly, the federal law that states parents must be involved in the educational decisions being made for their child. And a lot of parents do not know that. They allow, you know, they feel, well, we'll just give it to the professionals and do what they do. But then when these laws take place and it affects them, they're like, wait a minute, this is wrong. Why are you closing my school? Why are you doing this? And they need to know.
Joining us in the studio here in the conversation is Fred Jackson. He is with the Indiana Commission of Higher Education and represents the 21st Century Scholars Program. Thank you for joining us today, Fred.
Thank you.
What do you get to bring to the table for this big event coming up here in Gary this weekend?
Well, it's a great program that's about to happen this weekend. And with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education with 21st Century Scholars, is to bring awareness about the program. And a lot of parents who are involved in the program really knows about it. But in this area where I cover the Lake County area. That's 10 counties, 120 schools, 15,000 kids. Still really don't know the total makeup of the 21st Century Scholars Program. And just give you something, just really a snippet of it, is that kids who are in the 7th and 8th grade, they can enroll in the 7th, 8th grade. If they stay drug-free, crime-free, and graduate from high school with a 2.5 grade point average, the state of Indiana would pay for 4 years of their college tuition. That's something that I believe parents need to know about. The program has been around for the last 27 years. We have 110,000 kids who are enrolled into the program. We have 75,000 kids who are using the award now, and about 35,000 kids who have graduated from college by using the 21st Century Scholars Program. So it's a benefit, I think, that will be added to the parents to help them pay for school and it's an income qualified based program. But there are several, I should say hundreds of scholarships that are out there to help kids to pay for their college tuition.
Do you think it's a case where they just say not enough parents or students, for that matter, know that much about the program to take advantage of it, especially if they're out there, among other things, struggling to be able to bring in enough money to put a young person through school, pardon me, through school?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we do and what we have had great success in the past, we had developed a parent component, and that will keep parents aware of what is happening with the program. And also to help them navigate through the process. However, at that time, there was a paper application, and some counselors didn't complete the application or submit the application to the state office. Now the responsibility is on the parents. So now they can go online to scholars.in.gov and fill out the application. Also create a ScholarTrack account that will keep them abreast of what is out there and what's new with the 21st Century Scholars Program. And so they can be engaged as well with their child in the scholars program to make sure they are taken care of, you know, with the program.
Is this kind of program that's coming up this weekend in Gary very unique? Are there others that you're aware of around the state? Or is this something that's just kind of been started here and we're seeing how it goes in Northwest Indiana?
This is unique. This is going to be a unique program all by itself because of what is offering. Opportunity for parents to be indoctrinated what's going on the scene with the Department of Education and also with CHE, also the things which they need to know to help them this school semester to make sure their kids are in the right place at the right time, to empower them in a way that where I'll just add this piece in it, that with the state, that you can go back not only to help our kids to get to college, but also to put their parents in the same lane. So their parents who would like to go back to school and have started college but didn't complete, you can go back. We'll help them to achieve that, to get their degree as well.
So you're talking about basically a student of any age, I suppose. It can be a young person or it can be a grown-up.
Yes. Yes.
It's interesting. Janae, let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts about this coming weekend's event. We're of course, focusing in on the Northwest Indiana Parents Celebration and Education Expo that's going to happen at the Arts and Sciences Building on the IU Northwest campus mm-hmm. this weekend. Tell us about some of the things that will happen during the weekend and about the people that are helping make it possible.
Awesome. Yeah, it starts at 8 a.m. Registration is from 8 to 9, and then the event begins. We're going to make every effort to make it fun because we want parents to enjoy the process of their kids becoming educated as well as themselves, as Fred just said. So we're having breakout sessions where they have the opportunity to learn these different, to get this information that they need to navigate the system much better. I think a lot of people think that the education system is difficult. A lot of times they feel victims of it. But understanding how it works gives you so much power. That's the tagline that we have for Discover Your Power during this event. There's going to be a Q&A afterwards. There's going to be giveaways. We have a raffle crew, we call them, that comes in and does giveaways at the end of each breakout session, and they're going to make it really fun and silly. And then for lunch, instead of being stuck inside all day, Merrim Health Center is doing their Power of Healthy Families Health Fest from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. But our folks are going to be doing, our attendees are able to be a part of it from 11:45 to 1 for their lunch. Mm-hmm. And it's in Lot 9, which is literally half a block away from the Arts and Sciences Building, which is where we'll be having our event. It's completely free. Everything's free, so please come out. There's lots of giveaways. The raffles include uniform vouchers, but there's other stuff that we're raffling off, too, that I cannot tell you. In fact, I was told if I tell you that they will take it back. So it's that good. So
well,
I was like,
good.
I can't
that's
tell
good.
You.
And it's just good wise to be there. You know, right. Have the opportunity to be there. All right. If you're interested in participating in this, I guess they do as RSVP so they know you're coming. And tell us more about that.
Right. We ask that you RSVP just because we are limited in the number of folks that we can serve this time. So if this is a success, then Fred and I were discussing that there is state interest in it. And if this is successful, they would like to replicate this concept throughout the state. So we would like to see it become successful. So we're starting. So we're like the pilot. So we're asking for no more than 300 parents at this time, so we are limited. So we're asking you to RSVP either at 219-886-1111. I'll repeat that. It's 219-886-1111. Or if you go on Eventbrite and search for the NWI Parent Celebration and Education Expo, you can register there as well. If you'll let me, Chris, I'd like to just thank our partners, because like you were saying earlier, there's a bunch of people that are part of making this the success that we're hopeful that it'll be. So I already spoke of Indiana Commission for Higher Education, Indiana University, Indiana Parenting Institute's Responsible Parenting Campaign, Ivy Tech, Foundations of East Chicago, the Institute for Quality Education, Oak Street Health, NIPSCO, Work One, and Councilman at Large Herb Smith from Gary, and Gary Councilwoman Rebecca Wyatt. I want to thank all of them for their contributions to ensuring that this is going to be the success that we know it's going to be.
I was just thinking, Fred, if this weekend turns out to be a success, can you imagine what this might be like to have something similar like this in Indianapolis?
Yes, I think this it can spread out and really benefit the parents and students as well. This is something I think that is going to be, you know, epic. It's going to be huge, you know, and especially focusing on education, which we really need to begin to focus in on, especially for the next generation. And with next level jobs and next gen and the jobs and how the market is changing, we need to empower our kids with every tool that they can receive and put in their tool chest to make it happen.
May I throw something at you, Chris?
Sure.
Just, this is, and this will be the last thing that I say, that this event is not about giving parents information, but rather providing them with the understanding needed to make that knowledge work for them and their families.
Well, it's all helpful, you know. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be something that's on a piece of paper.
Right.
It'd just be an idea, and that's a not great opportunity to bring it up this weekend, to be sure, don't you think, Kendra?
Yes, definitely. And if anybody else would still, if any other companies or businesses would like to donate to this event as well, they are welcome, and we will make sure that they are totally acknowledged for their participation in this, because this is not just for Gary, Indiana. It is for Hammond, Griffith, East Chicago, all of Northwest Indiana. But the thing is, you got to call in, you got to reserve.
That's Kendra Jackson, excuse me.
Johnson.
And then, Johnson, I'm thinking Fred Jackson. Excuse me, my name's right here. Fred is with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education, and he represents the 21st Century Scholars Program. And as we mentioned, Kendra Johnson, as well as Janae Beleza, who is with the Indiana Parenting Institute. Once again, this is an event coming up on August 18th. It's the annual Northwest Indiana Parent Celebration and Education Expo, and it'll be held at the Arts and Sciences Building on the IU Northwest campus in Gary. And as you say, if you're interested, RSVP right away, and you can do so either on Eventbrite by looking up the Northwest Indiana Parent Celebration title, or you can call 219-886-1111 for more information. And thank you all for coming in the studio to talk about today.
And thank you for having us.
Thanks, Chris.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories, and it pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Music's always been a major part of my life. My parents, there was a theater in Chicago called the Regal Theater. And when I was growing up, as early as 2 years old, I can remember going over to the Regal and seeing people like Duke Ellington and Count Basie and Sarah Vaughan and all the top jazz people as I grew up. We lived upstairs on the second floor of my godmother's house. The piano actually was given to me by another godmother that I had. So we got the piano, and my mother said, well, you'll be taking piano lessons. Okay, you know. But the piano was on the front porch where I could look out and see everybody running up and down the street playing. So the deal was that I was going to practice every day for an hour, no matter what. And this friend would come over and he'd be sitting there because he wanted to go out and play. And I can remember him saying, can you hurry up? You know what I'm saying? There's no way to hurry up an hour. It is what it is. I tell people now, you know, I've never seen anybody make a dime playing hide and seek. Eventually, I grew to love it. You know, I'd be at the piano for 4 hours and not one. I really didn't actually learn how to play jazz until I got out of college and started rubbing elbows with other people who actually played the music. And I learned from them and kind of on the job training, really. I had a a trio, then I had a quartet, and then I formed a band that had five pieces. And at that time, there were about 30 different clubs in Gary where you could go from one spot and play, and the next weekend you could play someplace else. And we would actually, on our breaks, run from one club to the other to listen to another guy play and then come back and play some more. So that's really how this all got started. The thing is about jazz is that we have access to it. There's some things that some minorities don't even have access to. The symphony was something that we didn't have equal access to. You know, so you couldn't prove your mettle there. But jazz, you always could. It's one of the, I guess, racial forerunners in it, because there have been mixed bands since when? Whether you're white or black, once you hit the bandstand, then you're on your own. If you can play, you can play. If you can't, you know, you can't. And it's obvious to everybody. And I guess it's the same way in sports. It's an equalizer. Once here at the university, we played with a guy named Red Rodney. He was a white guy that played with Charlie Parker. He was telling us the story of when they went down south, he had red hair, kind of a light complexion, so they billed him as Albino Red, you know, because the mixed bands couldn't travel the south. When Duke Ellington went south, he rented a set of Pullman cars, and the guys would just travel the south. They wouldn't do hotels. Blacks couldn't stay in the regular hotels, so they worked off of the Pullman cars. Well, there's a jazz musician named Clark Terry, and he had played in this band that used to go down to Carroll, Illinois. My mother used to see that band. And he played in Duke Ellington's band for about 9 years. And so I was riding in the car with him, and I was saying, I know you used to play in Eddie Randall's band, and you guys used to go down to Carroll and play. And he said, oh, yeah, that's that city where the guy came up on the bandstand and cut Duke Ellington's tie in half. Those are the kinds of things that used to, you know, can you imagine a man of Duke Ellington's stature having something like that happen? My take on the whole thing is that all of the races on the planet were put here by God. All of us have different takes on things. If everybody would work together, you know, my strength might help you and your strength might help. It's like a puzzle. All the pieces of the puzzle can't be the same. You know, they have to be different. The differences are really a strength. I don't see why you would want to be by everybody that's just like you. If everybody were like me, it might be kind of sad, you know. I need somebody that plays the saxophone. I don't need a bunch of piano players.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeprojectoneword.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Ivy Tech Community College in Northwest Indiana is in the process of moving from their buildings at 35th Avenue and Martin Luther King Drive in Gary to the new Arts and Sciences building on Broadway, and also to the Gary Area Career Center. And they've been doing a lot of work at the Career Center these days and getting it ready for the Ivy Tech classes. And with us to talk about not only the work that is underway, but how a Northwest Indiana business and their public service project involved in this work as well, too. Michelle Meadows is the director of the Gary Career Center. And Michelle, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Well, tell us a little bit here about, first about the move, why the move is happening, and how things are coming along. And tell us where the Lowe's Heroes fit into all of this.
Well, as you mentioned, the Gary Ivy Tech is moving over into our location. They're bringing some of their programs over. One of the main ones that they're bringing over is the welding program. And that welding program then will be available also to our Gary Career Center students who come here, the high school students that feed into the Gary Career Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they've actually, like you said, been working extremely hard. We've got brand new equipment down there, brand new welders, lots of renovations taking place, and it's looking really good right now. In addition to that, as you mentioned, the Lowe's Heroes Project, we were selected as the Lowe's Heroes project for the Miraville store. And what happens is the Lowe's workers actually volunteer their hours. They come here, Lowe's, and Lowe's themselves, the Miraville store, actually purchases the material. They're coming here on August 18th and 19th. We'll probably be working 12-hour days, and we will be completely landscaping the front of the building. We're going to be painting the front of the building, basically giving the whole entire building a new facelift. And then shortly, you will probably be seeing a new Career Center sign out on Martin Luther King Drive that will be representing the Ivy Tech and the Gary Career Center kind of merger. So it'll be a nice new digital sign to let you know what's happening inside our building.
Now, from what you've been told, I'm sure you've been able to follow as well, too, inside the Career Center, even though the Gary Community School Corporation is not handling some of these duties, I would imagine some of it is probably contracted out. What kind of work have they been doing inside the building to get ready for adding on students from Ivy Tech?
Well, they've been doing a lot of just remodeling and spiffing up of inside. So they've painted, they've got new ceiling tile, they've got new floor tile, repainting of some safety lines, like I said, bringing in new equipment, new tables and chairs, and, you know, just this basic, the building itself is in extremely good condition, but it's just kind of beautifying the area.
When the Lowe's heroes, I guess is what they're called, when they get involved in projects like this, they're, I guess, following on some pretty basic tenets that I understand that Lowe's has set up for these community service groups. Tell us, if you will, about what Lowe's heroes kind of stand for and how they seem to fit so well with this project involving the Gary Area Career Center.
Well, the Lowe's stores in general like to be involved in their communities. And with that, they like to do service projects to help out, you know, nonprofit organizations and things like that to just help beautify their area, let them everyone know that they want to be a participating and active member of the community. And when I met with the manager from Lowe's and he came and visited me and I explained to him, you know, what my, you know, views were and where I was hoping to take the Career Center and what kind of things I needed, then he's like, this is perfect. This is exactly the type of things that they are trying to help, you know, beautify the community, be a part of an active member of the community. And that's basically how the Lowe's Heroes project came to the Career Center.
Now, we know that they're going to be over here on the 18th and 19th to do the landscaping and the painting on the outside of the building. What is the timetable that you folks are working with and having the entire center ready to go to handle the classes?
We've been working on that, getting ready for classes for a long time. I mean, we've been building enrollment and doing lots of recruiting of students to bring students back to the Career Center to show the people that the Career Center has always been open. We are very active. We've been bringing in some new programming, buying new equipment, upgrading any existing equipment that we have to make sure that whatever we teach here at the Career Center is up to date and it's new technology. And the Lowe's Heroes project, again, is just it's an upgrade to bring life back into the building and show the community and show the area that, you know, we are going, we are viable, and we hope people are more than welcome to come in and visit at any point in time.
Okay. When do classes start there at the Career Center this year?
We actually start on Monday the 13th. That's when the Gary schools go back into session.
Mm-hmm. So actually starting in now is when the time is available to be able to you can go outside here on the 18th and 19th and watch the Lowe's Heroes go to work, but there's a lot of activity that's been going on inside the building, and it's ready for students now, to be sure. We've been talking with Michelle Meadows, who's the director of the Gary Area Career Center, because the Gary Area Career Center is working with Ivy Tech Community College here in Northwest Indiana, getting the building ready, as Ivy Tech has been shifting their operations down to the Gary Area Career Center. They have been getting ready, and with the help of the Lowe's Heroes on August 18th and 19th, the outside of the building will be all spruced up and will look very nice. Michelle, thank you very much for being with us to talk about today.
All right, thank you for asking.
Well, we haven't talked with Pete Novak from the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors for a while, and most of the information we get, of course, is about home sales. But let's talk more about not only the most current figures on home sales for the month of June here in Northwest Indiana, but a little look at the 6 months that we've now at this point across 2018. Pete, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having us.
Well, let's first get the data that we have handy here on the number of homes here in Northwest Indiana in the seven-county region that the Association of Realtors covers for the month of June. How did the home sales seem to turn out?
Well, again, this year, and in June, you know, you're going to see a little bit of choppiness with the monthly home sales. So that's sort of the situation we're in right now with an inventory shortage. It just really depends on if buyers are finding what they're looking for. We remain in a market where demand is high for housing. It just really depends on if something is available for the buyer that they like, they're going to move on it. And in some cases, prices are rising so fast, we have some buyers just getting priced out. So that would be a little bit of a reason for some up and down. If we looked at the six-month total, it's probably exactly how I would have pictured the market coming into the year.
Mm-hmm.
Very modest growth in terms of closed home sales and a pretty sizable jump in terms of the median selling price. I think that's kind of what the market has been for the last couple of years, so no surprise there.
I know that looking just at Lake County alone here, they did pretty well at the 686 housing units that were sold in June, increase from what was sold this time last year, and an even bigger jump, I guess, going from between May and June is the big jump that we noted here, the 19% or so, almost 20% increase in between May and June. Is that because of, I guess, the time of year, the fact more people were out there looking?
It's partly that, and again, we've been a little bit in a choppy market for the last couple of years in terms of inventory. So, you know, when we look at the year-over-year comparisons, it could be possible that the month we're looking at, the current month, just was an amazing month, or it could be that the previous year's month was not a great month. And all that is just a matter of timing. And again, you know, it's just a situation where we know buyers are out there looking. It's just a matter of whether they're finding what they want. So this year so far, we've seen some pretty good jumps in Lake County, you know, both in terms of what happened in June and just really on the whole year. Lake County's been pretty solid. Same thing with Porter County. You could look at and see very similar numbers, maybe even better numbers on the Porter County side. But then you might look at some of the rural counties and see a little bit of slowdown. But to me, again, that just all just is a timing issue. You know, we have high demand, and it continues to be that kind of market, and we probably see that remaining for some time here.
And I know we've talked in past months and even years about this, too, and you mentioned it's always seems to have been the same, that we have this incredible increase in the demand for people wanting to go into housing, to change houses, to go from bigger houses to smaller houses, and then you've got the question of whether the inventory's out there, whether there are enough houses that people can buy that they happen to like, and we find it's sometimes pretty tough to be able to meet the demand, I would imagine. And we're in that case now, I guess.
Yeah, it is. It's some people might be confused. And when we say, well, the demand's continuing to grow, it's not necessarily growing. It's staying really high. What's happening is that we're actually getting less listings coming on the market. Sellers are just not choosing to sell, particularly in a market where they know demand is high. You would think oftentimes sellers might attempt to capitalize on that. We're in a market where there's rising prices. There's obviously plenty of potential home sellers out there who might like to capitalize on the equity that they've gained in their home, but for a variety of reasons, they are not putting their house up for sale. And there's no one particular reason, but probably a combination of reasons, at least based on the input we're getting from our membership out there. But that's really the situation. Each month that we've been tracking, we can see inventory declines, and it's really been happening since probably about 2014. And just what I guess we've been holding out hope for is that we'll start to see that change. We'll start to see more balance. We'll start to see more listings hit the market. It'll cool prices a little bit, which wouldn't be a bad thing because, like I said, we want to be gaining on pricing. But at the same time, if you rise too fast, well, I think we know how this story has ended before. And then also you have buyers who are just really getting priced out, particularly on the low end where they're trying to get into the housing market, but they just, you know, it's so competitive that they just can't really find what they're looking for either. So I think ultimately we hope that's the way the market goes. I will say it's been surprising that it's been this way for as long as it has been. But I guess we just have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Peter Novak, who is the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. And we've had this good luck in sales through the region here in the month of June. And it's compared well to recent months. And it's always the case, too, Pete, isn't it, that we talk about the demand, and the fact is that the demand is out there and people are looking for houses. And it's still pretty tough to find new houses, too. More contractors are building more houses here in Northwest Indiana, but it's apparently not enough to meet the demand.
Yeah, no, they have not. And if you actually talk to the builders, which we do from time to time, and things are going well, I'm hearing a lot of very positive things. And, of course, we're building more today than we were a year ago or even the year before that. But at the same time, you're right, it's still not at the point where it is satisfying demand. So, you know, that market is a little bit constrained as well, just in terms of what they're able to produce and what, you know, what buyers are out there seeking. So certainly that's a part of it also.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking ahead to the rest of 2018, you mentioned that it seems to be holding steady and then have improvements as well. Do we see the improvements not only in sales, but also in what the median price for these homes that are sold will be?
Yeah, again, it certainly is a guessing game. I would guess personally more of the same throughout the rest of the year. There's certainly some individuals who start to look at the housing market and go, okay, you know, we're starting to see a slowdown. What's happening? Are we looking to have a turn here? And yet, let me say also, you know, we've really seen a pretty solid run here. Prices have been rising since about 2012 overall. So, I mean, that's a good solid six-year run. And, you know, that may happen in the future also, but I think it just really depends on who you ask. And this market is quite a bit different than, you know, the market we had in the mid-2000s, Chris, and one big thing of note is specifically the inventory levels, which is what we're talking about.
Right.
You know, if you compare the inventory levels now versus what they were in the mid-2000s, they look entirely different. We had much more supply then. And when the market crashed at that time, that left us with a lot, you know, home sellers with a lot of supply that, really the only thing that they really could do if they really had to move was slash the prices. That's not this kind of market. Again, if demand went away tomorrow, it certainly would be a bad thing for the market. But one positive note of that would be we wouldn't really be stuck with a ton of supply because we just don't really have any. So definitely different markets, and it remains to be seen what the future holds, and only time will tell. But I think we'll continue to feel pretty positive about the housing market, at least for the near future.
Now, let me ask you, do you have a chance to talk with your colleagues at other realtors organizations around the state of Indiana? What are they telling you about their particular regions? Are we all pretty much in the same boat, so to speak?
Yeah. It's a national issue, yeah. No question, and it has been for quite time. So, you know, some areas obviously are a little bit better than others, and, you know, again, when you talk about some of the really hot markets out there across the country, that's even more of an issue for them. But, you know, again, it is a national issue, and it's not necessarily particular to Northwest Indiana.
Well, so it certainly seems that you would think in places like Central Indiana, where we have a lot more people moving into some of the surrounding counties around Indianapolis and going into these other counties and looking for homes, and they're probably have the same big demand for places out there and the same tight supply as well.
Yeah, it is, no question. The hotter markets definitely get that, but I get asked that question often, Chris, and I'll tell you it's just as competitive in Hammond, Indiana, and Whiting, Indiana, and some other places as well. So it's not necessarily the newer, growing communities that are having that issue. You know, again, it's really across the board, and I'd look at some of the communities that I mentioned and others also here in Northwest Indiana that have that same issue. It's not necessarily in our area. If we were looking at the St. John's and the Crown Points and the Valparaisos, certainly it's an issue there, but it also is an issue in some of the places I mentioned as well.
Now, one other thing, too, we always talk, of course, more about single-family homes, about duplexes and the like. How about the bigger units that are out there? We see a lot of new construction out there, I guess, and not necessarily in apartments, but I guess they are being built out there, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, we are seeing new developments in general, you know, and particularly on the rental side. You know, rental prices have been high also throughout this same time that the market's been really well. And more importantly, just the economy's doing better. Banks, I think, are looking at you know, a little more ways to be more lenient and get involved in different projects. And so, you know, both, you know, in terms of some of the commercial stuff we're seeing out there, and also just even the single-family developments or the, you know, the townhome developments and things of that nature, all of that is definitely doing a lot better than it was in the past, and I think we'll see more of that in the future also.
Well, sounds like good news for realtors and good news for people that are looking to sell homes, and just a little tougher for people trying to buy homes, even if they're trying to downsize a bit too. They're out there looking for, you know, in a tough market to find the homes in, but we're working our way through it apparently. Thank you very much, Pete, for talking about this, and we appreciate the comments and the insight, and we'll be checking back with you again.
Sounds great, Chris. We appreciate you covering this as well. Thanks.
Peter Novak is the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana native B.J. Hollers, now a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin in Eau Claire, has a deep interest in the American civil rights movement and a flair for some creative nonfiction that seems to now have converged into a new book, which is called The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Julia Meek learned that Hollers was in Fort Wayne for an author visit at the downtown public library, so she invited him into the studio to talk about his interest in the important part of America's history, how it developed, and where the journey has led.
BJ Hollers, welcome.
Thank you so much, Julia.
You brought new light and insight to the Freedom Writers chapter of the 1961 Civil Rights Movements. Now, that's a very significant moment in history. BJ, really briefly, would you outline the cause in its context of desegregation for us?
Well, the Supreme Court passed two rulings that made it very clear that it was unconstitutional to have segregated seating on interstate buses and their facilities. The problem, though, was that local law enforcement didn't always make good on those constitutional rulings.
And so something had to be done.
Something had to be done, and the Congress of Racial Equality took it upon themselves to plan a bus ride to test these enforcement policies.
So what drove you to revisit the cause and especially to meet the writers themselves?
Well, a couple of things. The first was my students. I think there's this sense, especially from young people, you know, college-age students who, when things aren't going their way politically or in some other capacity, they think they're sort of helpless to do anything about it. And I really wanted to empower them and say, no, I mean, throughout the civil rights movement, young people just like yourselves were the ones on the front lines. And I think the Freedom Riders are a great example of that.
You are teaching at the University of Wisconsin, and so this is, of course, many years later, and it's many worlds away, we might say, but the same kind of impact hits these kids when they hear stories like this, it sounds like.
I think so, yeah. I'm at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and so it's a predominantly white student body, and a lot of times folks, maybe in the North generally, but certainly in places like Indiana and Wisconsin, they think, oh, civil rights must have been tough in the South, you know, and it's always really interesting when I give readings in the North. People always want to know, well, what's it like in the South where racism exists? And I always try to make clear the South doesn't have a monopoly on racism. You know, we've got our own problems right here as well, worth addressing.
A good point to bring up and to follow through with. And in that line, what kind of research and preparation did this whole revisitation require?
Oh, a lot. I always joke, you know, I'm not the best writer in the world. I'm not the best researcher. And what I try to bring to the story is just a new take, a new and personal take. So while many historians have written the story of the Freedom Riders from a historical perspective, I wanted to try to bring these stories back to life. I was less interested in what happened on this particular day and time, but more about what was in the hearts of these people when they were boarding these buses, knowing they were risking their lives in the process.
And this really does make history come alive, I think. Of course, theoretically, it's going to do so. Is that what it did to you as you were planning this?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a moment where I was visiting a lot of Freedom Riders in the Greyhound station where they were beaten 55 years ago to the day. And we're all there and the museum's closing down for the day. And I'm sticking around with the Freedom Riders and suddenly they break into these freedom songs and they kind of like push me into their circle and we're all singing these freedom songs. And there are a few moments in my life when I felt electricity like that.
Oh my goodness. Yes. What a remarkable situation. But then you yourself got all of that together to happen that way. And good for everybody, it sounds like.
Well, I was happy to be a part of it, that's for sure.
Indeed. Now, your actual plan even involved, of course, your class and a busload of these college kids. Was that all the psychological part of it, to be on the bus retracing the path that way?
Absolutely. The Civil Rights Pilgrimage, as it's called at our university, happens twice a year. I was sort of just a writer myself. I didn't organize it or anything. I just kind of took my seat alongside 100 students, and it was one heck of a way to spend spring break, let me tell you. But we really got to be close to one another and to have these late night conversations in the hotels of what we saw and experienced. And learning what it meant to them was really enlightening throughout the writing of this book.
Speaking of writing the book, did you know from the start that you wanted to write about this whole experience?
I knew Freedom Rides was at the core of it all. An interesting thing happened in that I was having a dinner one evening in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and a gentleman asked if I knew a guy named Jim Zwerg. And I went through my mental Rolodex. I couldn't remember quite who Jim Zwerg was. And then he said, you know, the Freedom Rider. And then I come to find that a guy named Jim Zwerg was an associate pastor at the church I actually attend in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, who happened also to be seatmates with current Congressman John Lewis, you know. And yet the fact that we had roamed the same town 40 years apart had never even been made public. He kept this very private. And so when I learned that there was a local connection to a major Freedom Rider, that was the moment I knew I needed to pursue this fully.
You were destined to do this.
You know, I kind of feel that way myself when I picked up the phone and called Jim Zwerg. I mean, within 5 minutes, we were talking about our favorite places in Eau Claire and what it was like raising our young children there. And there was just so much kismet. Of course, the major difference being that he's a civil rights icon, but I can certainly appreciate that and strive to do my own humble part.
And you have done quite a part, to be sure. And creative nonfiction is your specialty, BJ. So writing, teaching, mentoring, you do it all. How did your own expertise exactly determine your approach to your researching and writing?
Well, something I talk to my students about a lot is trying to find a new, an original approach to a subject. And so many subjects have been written about, to the moon and back, and that's true of civil rights too. A lot of folks have written incredible books about civil rights. What can this white guy from Fort Wayne, Indiana possibly contribute to this subject? And for me, it was all a matter of getting in the car and retracing the route. That was what made this unique for me. It wasn't just sitting in the armchair doing the research. I was knocking on doors. I was visiting churches. I was visiting people at their kitchen tables, you know, and that was such a cool experience to sit on a porch swing with Dr. Martin Luther King's former neighbor, you know, and have her point out where Dr. King would walk down the street and where he played pool and where he got his haircut. And he used to come up to this very porch on Sundays and chat with my mom. I mean, these stories are things you're not going to find in any history book. But for me, those are the things that really let history come alive.
Did you have any dream that you were going to be able to unearth these kind of moments when you started this whole thing?
You know, people never let me down. I think the best thing I've learned in the various books I've written, especially related to civil rights, this is my third book on civil rights, is if you knock on a door and you enter a person's residence with just a pure intention of listening, not of talking, not of lecturing, but just sitting quietly, people will share all kinds of important things with you. And when I can, I like to give a bit of myself back to them. I'm not mining you for information. We're having a conversation here. It goes both ways. So kind of navigating between the no one to shut your mouth and no one to give a little of yourself, I think really allows the relationship to blossom beyond just the interview itself.
That might be one of the biggest tips that you can teach your own creative nonfiction classes, as well as listen to yourself. I certainly understand that. And now I am kind of curious, you spent one-on-one time with 8 of America's major heroes and chiros that are with us in the 21st century. What kind of life-changing effect did this have on you?
Oh, it's so hard to even describe it. You know, I guess the best example I can give is what happened last spring, or maybe it was a year ago now. I was teaching a creative writing nonfiction class, and I see on my phone that Dr. Bernard Lafayette is calling. He's this incredible freedom writer, civil rights activist, Dr. King's right-hand man. If you see his name pop up on your phone, you stop whatever you're doing. And so certainly I picked up, I explained I'm in the middle of a class. I'd love for you to chat with my students. I'd be happy to. So here were 20 students crowded around my cell phone on speaker, and he was telling us about spending Dr. King's last night with him and kind of hashing out this press release in the hotel there in Memphis. And I mean, it was the best class I've ever been a part of. And again, it was the result of shutting my mouth. I see a trend coming on here. But again, I think that's part of it for me. We didn't end our relationship when the book came out. I've heard from Jim Zwerg, who wanted to talk more about a letter I found that his mother wrote to Robert F. Kennedy. I still talk to Charles Persten and many of the writers who just want to know what a white guy in Wisconsin feels about this matter or that matter, you know, and I obviously want to know their perspectives too. So the fact that the conversations are ongoing, I mean, that's a reward far more important to me than any kind of monetary reward I might get from this book, yes. Which I assure you would be modest anyway. But nonetheless, having these numbers in my phone, knowing that they have my number, that's worth a lot.
The good fortune of continuing to associate with them, that's just wonderful. And what they can share and what you can share, that's all so important. It sounds like the writers then, as now, are gravely concerned that the message didn't get broadcast as much as it should have. What do you think?
I think they raise a good point. When we think about civil rights movement, we think of Dr. King, we think on the March on Washington, we think of I Have a Dream, and sometimes it kind of stops around there. The Freedom Writer story is just one more incredible facet of a much larger story in American civil rights. Books could be written about any one month of any one year in the 60s, you know, volumes of books. And so I think there's an important point there, which is we all have a responsibility not only to take note, but to ask ourselves a question that Charles Persten asked of me, which is simply, what would you get on the bus for? The question, of course, implicit in that question is the question of what do you care about so deeply that you'd be willing to risk your life? For me, that's not just a hypothetical anymore. Sure, it's something we can think about as we're walking our dogs and brushing our teeth, but perhaps now more than ever, we should consider, you know, what do we care about so deeply that we'd be willing to proverbially get on the bus for?
Is that something that you can convey to a young kid in the 21st century?
I sure try to. And when I close a lot of my readings and presentations, I say that very thing. You know, when you're walking back to your cars tonight, when you're hopefully continuing these conversations with your friends and family members, think seriously about that question. And if we can find an answer there, don't just stop with the answer. Then ask yourself, what's the next step?
Great point. As a matter of fact, how do the freedom writers that you discuss things with and your own self, how do you think this all parallels with today's rights issues and hate and misperceptions of things?
My hope is that this book isn't ever viewed as a history book or a story of history. There's certainly many historical elements to be sure, but I hope it could also serve as a teaching tool or a tool of inspiration to show modern citizens in 2018 a model that works. You know, here's what young people did in the summer of 1961 to ensure that change came about. You know, this didn't just happen on its own. This was 400 people who got on buses and risked their lives to achieve an outcome. And I think today, it's often the same. Certainly, the mechanism with which we create social change is dramatically different in terms of the tools at our disposal. But what's not different is just the fact that it takes human beings. You know, you don't have to be a millionaire. You don't have to be a politician. You have to be committed to a cause and create the conditions that allow people to work together for that common cause.
Okay, BJ, bottom line, what's the most important thing you feel you learned from this journey and you were able to share with the world through your writing?
For me, I think it's the idea that creating change isn't someone else's problem or duty or responsibility. If you're hearing this, if you're listening, if you crack the book open once, hopefully you'll leave knowing that it's your responsibility too. And if we value that change, if we want the world to be a better place, if we want to reach the beloved community that Dr. King spoke so eloquently about, it starts with us. There's no one else we can pass that buck to. It starts with us.
BJ Hollers is an associate professor of English at the University of Wisconsin and author of The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. BJ, it was a pleasure to speak with you on your writing and your whole belief system. Carry it on.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Julia Meek. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll join us tomorrow when we have a conversation with Steve Beekman from the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. He'll talk about the latest in the campaign.